The following is intended solely for the use of those with a sense of adventure.
I'm shaking the dust of this town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world.
This is Travel with Hawkeye. Here's your host, Mark Hawkeye Lewis.
This is the fifth year of our travel show, Travel with Hawkeye, but this is the first year that we put together the podcast. And I wanted to go back at the end of 2017 and kind of share with you some of the favorite people and favorite moments of the past year on our podcast. And I have been really blessed to meet some incredible people. So on our podcast today, we're going to go back and listen to our portions of interviews from Eric Weihemeyer, who has climbed Mount Everest and all seven of the largest peaks in the world. But there's something extraordinary about Eric Weihemeyer that differentiates him from any adventurer. We'll talk to him. Also, we'll talk to Dion Leonard, who wrote the book Finding Gobi. Dion ran across the Gobi Desert in an ultra marathon and found a little dog that started following him. And the story of what happened between him and the dog has gathered international attention and soon will be making a motion picture. We'll talk to Dion also on the podcast today. One of my favorite interviews this year has also been with Wendy Simmons, who went to North Korea as a tourist. And her observations, especially in this time with North Korea being in the news so much, are so poignant, and we'll revisit that interview also. Also got a chance this year to talk to Joel Satori. He's a photographer for National Geographic, and you may have seen his exhibits on zoos across America, also on PBS this year, something called the Photo Ark, where he is documenting every single animal that's extinct. And there's 13,000 of them. And we'll talk also with Joel. Also in 2017, we got a chance to talk to Brenda Cantrell. And she is one of the employees of one of the most unusual places in America called the Unclaimed Baggage Center in Scottsboro, Alabama. And she is just a hoot. That was definitely one of my favorite interviews. And then to top it all off, also going to be talking to master distiller Jack Arnett from the Jack Daniel's Distillery. He was also on one of our episodes, just an enlightening interview as they started the brand new Tennessee Whiskey Trail. It's not unlike the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. That started this year, and we talked to Jack also in 2017. So a chance to talk to some incredible people. I'm going to kick it off with our interview with Eric Weihemeyer. Eric Weihemeyer has climbed Mount Everest. He's climbed El Capitan. He recently kayaked, or actually had a book about his exploits of kayaking the entire 270 miles of the Grand Canyon. And he's also climbed the seven largest peaks in the world. He was on episode 14 of this year's Travel with Hawkeye podcast if you want to hear our entire interview. But the thing that makes him so extraordinary is, well, I'll let Eric tell you himself.
Well, when I was about a week before my freshman year in high school, I went blind. So I've done all that stuff without my eyes, but with my ears and my sense of touch and my team, and just, you know, it's been a great adventure. So, yeah, I've been blind for, 30 years.
Yeah, and you take that to aside, and still your adventures are quite amazing. And I'm going to ask you a few things about Mount Everest, because you are the first person I've ever talked to about Mount Everest. I'll ask you about that in a few moments and everything. But I read in this article in Men's Journal, it said that you kind of started to get your taste of adventure when you went to a summer camp and you went rock climbing and you found you had a natural aptitude for it.
Yeah, I mean, so I loved baseball and basketball and traditional sports. And I, you know, as I went blind, I realized that was not happening as I got pounded in the face with the basketball. And so I thought I needed a safer sport. So I there's this recreational program for blind kids. And it was like the first time they were taking blind kids out to do different things because we were missing out on ball sports. So they took us horseback riding and canoeing and sailing. And one weekend they took us rock climbing. And I love that other stuff. It was really fun. But rock climbing, I thought, this is such a definition of adventure for me. You know, feeling my way up the rock face with my hands and my feet. Not, you know, I couldn't see the holes, but I could sort of scan my way up the face and problem solve my way up the rock. And I got to this little dish, maybe like 100 feet up, and I was over the trees, and I could listen to the, you know, blind people use sound vibrations, listening to the kind of the echo off of the valley. I could hear that valley below me, and I just thought, this is so different from what I thought blindness would be. So I kept climbing.
Yeah, and when you went up El Capitan, how long did that take you to go up El Capitan? Because I've seen that before, and it's so dramatic, just the flatness of El Capitan. I just think, man, I don't even see how anybody could even do that. I just is it advantage
what's
beautiful
not be- is that there are these series of cracks running up El Capitan, and so there's like hundreds of routes up the face. So as long as you can follow some of those crack systems, you can kind of slowly make your way up, and it's like, you know, 27 rope lengths to the top. The first time it was climbed in like, I don't know, several months or maybe 6 months of kind of slowly working the rope up the rock face. And my friend Hans Florian's climbed it in like less than 3 hours now. It's insane. My ascent was just somewhere in the middle. It was about 2.5 days, which is sort of a typical length of time. And I got to lead some of the climb, which is really cool because, you know, following is fun, but leading up the crack and placing the pieces of gear and bringing your team up, that's really one of the cool parts about climbing. You know, you get out there and lead, and you share the risk of, you know, of trying to move the team up the face. And so for me, being blind and getting to do that was really cool.
When you said it took you a couple of days, so you obviously camped out. Did you camp out in one of those tents that's just kind of hanging on the side of the rock, or did you find a flat spot for your tent?
The cool part about the nose route, which is the most prominent route up El Capitan, is that there are ledges. So they're little ledges. I mean, there's some that are actually kind of big that you can stand on, and others that are, you know, just like a couple feet wide, and you anchor yourself to the rock with your harness, and then you know, so that when you roll over in the night, it's not a big roll.
Oh my God. Oh no, thank
and then you.
You
just sleep on these little tiny ledges, and it's really cool because you're just like in this vertical world, and by the time you get to the top of El Capitan, you know, as I said, 2.5 days later, you've climbed out over this huge roof, and like you can hear the valley below you, 3,000 feet. Like if you jumped off the rock, you would hit the valley floor. I mean, there's nothing to stop you.
Yeah,
it's just so out there, and you crawl up over the top, and then you're standing on the top of El Capitan. And my family were there to meet me, my wife and my dad. They all hiked up to the top on a, you know, non-technical way, and met us at the top with like yoo-hoos and grape soda and all sorts of good stuff.
If you want to learn more about Eric's adventures, especially his trip up Mount Everest or his trip down the Grand Canyon in a kayak, check out episode 14 of our Travel with Hawkeye podcast. I'll have to say, probably one of my favorite books, travel books of the past couple years, is Wendy Simmons, who wrote a book on her trip to North Korea. And that's in episode 4. You can hear the entire interview there. But here's a little clip of Wendy talking about this amazing travel book that she wrote that is titled...
The title of the book is My Holiday in North Korea, The Funniest Worst Place on Earth. And that about sums it up. It was literally the funniest worst place I've ever been. And, you know, as someone who has been traveling her whole life and has been to so many places and, you know, lots of places off the beaten path, lots of places that are very impoverished or very difficult and so forth, you know, this really somehow took the cake. And, you know, it's a country that's maligned consistently in our media and ridiculed and all these things. And even with all that, it sort of surpassed my expectations. And, you know, the people are the people and they're not the government. And, you know, and I want to make that delineation because it's not the people's fault that their country is the way it is, but it's one of the craziest places I've ever been there. It's the Truman Show. It's literally a country where everyone is in on it, where everyone is making a concerted effort to make you believe that it's a better place than it is. And I think at the end of the day, that's what makes it so disconcerting. You know, when you go someplace else, whether it's the Congo or Ukraine or, you know, anywhere else, America for that, you know, that matter, where there's poverty or there's political tumult or, you know, any of the problems that befall any country on the planet, you know, the citizens are talking about it. There's discourse. There's, you know, there are people that are grumbling. There's honesty and truth to what you're seeing. And when you go to North Korea, everyone is trying to make you think everything's fine.
You know,
it's very unsettling.
That's very, very interesting. You know, I read an article in Ski Magazine, of all places, about North Korea. I think it was last year. They asked a couple of writers to visit a North Korean ski resort, and it was very similar to what you said. There was this effort to make it seem like this is just a normal place. And while they were in their hotel, a couple people who looked like they were workers in the hotel got on the elevator with them, and they were not supposed to see them. They looked very impoverished, and like they were almost starving, and there was this embarrassment, like, you are not supposed to see us. And I wonder if you had any experiences like that.
Constantly. Absolutely. Every single day I had an experience like that. Either there, you know, you anything you see that's real is an accident. And otherwise, they're actively trying to set scenes for you to see that, again, show you that everyone's happy, that everyone's well off, that everyone is living happy, normal lives. You know, you're walking onto a Hollywood movie set. And when anything goes wrong, or when you see anything that would be considered, you know, less than the perfect standard, they've made a mistake. You know, the KITC, that, you know, the organization in North Korea that organizes your itinerary and gives you the handlers, and basically it's, you know, the party planners of your trip. They have, or do, meticulously plan and organize every hour that you are in North Korea from beginning to end. And, you know, I talk about this in my book. When, you know, you're on Earth, you're still on planet Earth. And yeah. So things go wrong. And when they do, they scramble to you know, mask that something's gone wrong, or they just pretend it's not happening, which is the craziest part. So, you know, there's an anecdote where we're standing in the driveway waiting for the car and it's raining. And I say, oh, it's so sad, it's raining. And my handler says, oh, nice sunny day. I mean, it's literally that extreme. So
wow.
It's just, yeah, it's nuts. You know, you start to lose your mind a little bit because you have people all day long telling you things that are just clearly not true. And, you know, but they're, what you're faced with is trying to understand whether they believe it or not.
And what was your conclusion at the end? What was your conclusion? Do they believe it, or are they, you said, you know, they're in on it. Do they believe it, or are they in on it? And if they are in on it, why does everybody feel they have to be in on it?
I don't think most people believe it, you know, at this point. I really don't. I think that with tourism, and, you know, now with the ability to slip information over the border, you know, with little tiny X drives, and with, there's just more awareness and information. And they had, you know, a massive starvation where people lost confidence in the government years ago. With the change of power, you know, two leaders back, there was real love and affection for the leader. I don't think the new leader encourages that the same way. But, you know, there's fear. They don't have the ability yet in that country to, you know, to come together and protest. There's still no way for people to communicate. It's better, I think, than probably it's been in the past. But it's not as if, you know, they can raise a quorum, or that they have the internet, or they can gather on the streets without being punished for that. You know, there's still a climate where people turn one another in. And, you know, they're not at a point yet, for example, where countries were during Arab Spring, where the people, you know, had come, you know, came together. There's still a lot of fear. And but I, you know, that was what I struggled with the entire time, with how much I was with two handlers, two women. Basically, unless I was alone in my hotel room at night, I was with these women 24/7. And I would, you know, I just would stare at them and try to understand what they believed and what they were trying to make themselves believe for my benefit and for their own, so they wouldn't lose their minds living there.
The book is called My Holiday in North Korea, The Funniest, Worst Place on Earth. Wendy Simons is our guest.
Yep.
I can tell you right now, I don't think I've been more excited about a book to read in a long time. I really can't wait for this. I've been fascinated with North Korea, and just your description of it just has whetted my appetite. I have to ask you, though, you said often it seems like a movie set. Can you give a specific example of something you saw that like gave you that impression?
Well, for example, I went to a football game that, they schedule, as I said, they schedule activities for you every single hour. And if, you know, if anything goes wrong or something needs to be rescheduled, they're on it. I mean, they are on it. And on the day before, at like 6 o'clock, I was informed that my activity for 9 o'clock the next morning on Monday had to be changed. And they read me a list of things I could do, and they sort of sheepishly mentioned football game, meaning soccer. Uh-huh. And I said, sure, that'd be great. And so, you know, they made a series of phone calls and then came back to tell me that I was so lucky because there was a football game scheduled for 9 o'clock in the morning the next day, which is obviously a very unusual time
yes.
for a major football game to take place. And when I arrived at the stadium, which was the second largest stadium in Pyongyang, the one that used to be the main stadium, there was a real football game happening, but there was no one really in the crowd in the stadium, maybe like 50 people, because I think they hadn't been able to organize a crowd yet. And then halfway through the game, hundreds and hundreds of people showed up, as if, you know, it took them a little extra longer to get the people to come. And the way that, you know, I talk about this in the book also, in North Korea, everybody sort of walks in these lines of six or five across and six or five deep. And so at halftime, you know, like this veritable spreadsheet of people sort of arrived and, you know, looking somewhat confounded and staring at me. You know, like, it was just, everyone was very confused about why they were there. So, you know, it's things like that take place all the time.
Wendy is a great travel writer, and I'll tell you, you need to check out episode 4. That's probably my favorite episode of Travel with Hawkeye for 2017, because some of the tales that she tells in the rest of the interview are just mind-blowing, and it's so poignant at this time of year. Episode 4, Wendy Simmons talking about her trip to North Korea. On a little lighter note, there's a place in Scottsboro, Arizona called the Unclaimed Baggage Center. So if you lose your bag and the airline can't find you, this is where it ends up. And we had Brenda Cantrell from the Unclaimed Baggage Center, and I had to ask, has anybody ever come into the store and found something that they had lost that is on your shelves?
Not intentionally. It's a really funny story. This has probably been about 10 years ago, but it's the only documented case that we have. There might, you know, be some other stories out there. But a gentleman had come in his first time shopping at the store and bought a pair of ski boots that looked like something his wife, you know, could wear. And he took them back to Georgia, and she said these looked really familiar. She lifted up the tongue of the boot, and there was her maiden name. And those were her boots that she had lost on a previous trip and had received settlement, you know, some type of insurance settlement from the airline. And then he bought back her favorite boots for $45.
Fantastic. Okay, now, we know that you have luggage there and clothes, because that's what most people pack. But what kind of other items that most people wouldn't think about are in the Unclaimed Baggage Center?
Let me tell you, electronics in the last, you know, 6-8 years have just really skyrocketed. And interestingly enough, we also buy things that are left on the plane, the carry-on items. And those are not covered by the airline because, you know, you as the passenger obviously left that in onto your responsibility.
Yeah.
And so you think about not just carry-on bags, but laptops and iPads and headphones and kids' games and, of course, we get blankets and neck pillows and, you know, jackets and things like that. But electronics, like crazy, we get them. Jewelry. We get lots of jewelry, impressive jewelry. I'm not just talking about, you know, run down the street to the local store and get it. We have a $40,000 bracelet in our store right now. That's the appraisal value. And we sell the fine jewelry at half the appraisal value. So you can get it for the bargain price today of about $21,000.
Wow. Now, I would think that like a laptop or an iPhone, that might be easy to trace whose it is.
Well, actually, it's not as easy as you would think. I mean, in particular with an iPhone, with all the security features that go on them now, you can't, nobody can bypass it except the owner, you know, the law.
Yeah.
But again, it's not the airline's responsibility on laptops and things like that that are left on the plane. I mean, they'll do what they can. And some airlines do offer a service for the lost and found type item. But for the most part, those things, you know, are securely locked. And we go through a Department of Defense protocol to clear all the contents and, you know, and then get ready to sell.
Okay. Now, Scottsboro, Alabama, I assume that's not the biggest city in Alabama.
I think you would be correct in that assumption.
I have two questions about Scottsboro. One, is this like a tourist destination? Because I would go out of my way to stop here.
Well, there's a lot of people that go out of their way to come see us. We're one of the top attractions in the state of Alabama. I just reported our numbers to the tourism department for 2015, and we had nearly, as normal, nearly 1 million visitors that came to our store. I mean, here's the thing. The town is about 15,000 people. We're tucked right into the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains with the Tennessee River and Lake Gunnersville and just this mountainous scene. And it's just beautiful in its own right. And people come here, you know, to fish and to do water sports. But I would absolutely say the biggest draw to this part of the state is Unclaimed Baggage Center.
Okay. Now, I have to think, what is it like to be a merchant in Scottsboro, Alabama, when you have this incredible array of electronics and clothes and luggage at the Unclaimed Baggage Center? What is it for like the other merchants in your town?
Well, let me tell you, we have a lot of antique stores and thrift stores because they know that people are coming here to shop for deals and they get on the bandwagon.
I understand. Well, what's some of the most unusual things that have been ended up at the Unclaimed Baggage Center in Scottsboro, Alabama?
Well, we've had several suits of armor, full suits of armor.
Are you serious?
Yes, we have. We've had ones that are like the medieval ones, those that look like they're from somewhere in Asia. We get all kinds of interesting musical instruments from all over the world that we actually have to research. We have to research a lot of things that we have no idea what they are. I mean, of course, we have contracts with domestic airlines, but we get a lot of international items as well.
Sure.
You know. We get taxidermied items. We have, snake skins. We have deer hanging on the wall. We have moose antlers. We had a live rattlesnake at one point in time.
Wow.
Thankfully, we haven't had any more of those over the years. You know, one of the things that people are excited about right now, just because of recent news, is the movie Labyrinth. That was a Jim Henson production. And in that movie was the character Hoggle. And with David Bowie's passing, it's kind of brought, you know, his acting career back to the light. And there's quite a cult following for this movie Labyrinth that really took off well after the movie was released. It was, you know, it's just kind of a growing thing. But we have the actual puppet, Hoggle, that was made for the movie Labyrinth. It came to us not long after the movie wrapped, and we've had him in our possession for almost 30 years. And, of course, technology and tracing is night and day different from what it was, you know, all those years ago. And the Henson Company knows that we have him. They know that we take care of him. He is very well cared for, but he's actually on display in our museum.
I still wonder, who is traveling with a suit of armor? That was Brenda Cantrell from the Unclaimed Baggage Center in Scottsboro, Arizona. That is episode 22, if you want to learn more about that on Travel with Hawkeye on our podcast. Also, this year, we got to talk to Dion Leonard in episode 16. Dion Leonard is an ultra-marathoner, and he ran a race across the Gobi Desert, 150 miles. That in itself is extraordinary. But there's a story that has caused worldwide attention because of a small dog, which he named Gobi. I'll let Dion tell you the story of Gobi.
This little dog would actually join the first day with some American runners, and she would cross the largest sand dune in China and come into the campsite and get food off people and decide that she was going to stay with us. But on day two of the race, she actually decided that she was going to run with me, and she ran the whole stage with me, and we crossed a large mountain range and through the desert. And, yeah, we became inseparable from that, basically.
Okay, and this dog, Gobi, I encourage people, and I'll link this to our website, or you can just go to the website, findinggobi.com, is the cutest dog I have ever seen in my life. But it's a really, really small dog. It's not a big dog.
No, she's a tiny little Shih Tzu Chihuahua, and we think that's what she is, Shih Tzu Chihuahua mix. But she keeps up. She does 6-7 minute mile pace with me quite easily, and she would often quite run ahead of me and look behind and wait for me to catch up to her. And nothing really fazed her, and she really chose me and wanted to be with me. And, throughout the race, that's where our journey sort of began. But I'd finish the race with her, and she would run 77 miles of it. Four stages of the race, but I would have to come back to Edinburgh where I live, and she stayed out there, but unfortunately she went missing during that time. So I had to fly back and see if I could reconnect with her and find her again and make this story happen.
Yeah, so let me just expand on that timeline a little bit. During the race, she stayed with you for the most part, and had you decided, correct me if I'm wrong, had you decided at the end of the race that you wanted to take Gobi back with you to Scotland? You just can't do it that quickly?
No, I made her a promise while we were doing, out there in the middle of one of the nights. I said to her, I'm going to promise to bring you home to the UK and give her a better life. And I had a very sort of abusive and difficult childhood upbringing myself. And during the race, I saw something in Gobi that was someone needed to sort of step up and give her a better life. And she deserved it. And I wanted to be that person to help her. So I hatched a plan during the race to actually bring her back. I knew that as soon as I could finish and ring my wife and suggest to her that I was bringing this dog home and try and work out the possibilities to how to bring her home would be a lengthy journey in itself.
Okay, so you go back to Scotland. You can't bring Gobi back right away. You leave Gobi in China. Where was the town that you left her at?
She was left in Urumqi, which is a city of 3 million people. So there was actually a load of quarantine and medical work and paperwork and things that needed to be sorted to be able to just actually get it moved from being basically out in the desert to Beijing or Shanghai, where she could start all of those procedures. So it was during that period that she went wandering, went looking for me, is what a lot of people think, and that's where all the trouble started. So I was back in Edinburgh, received a phone call and telling me that she'd gone missing, and I had to sort of fly back as quickly as I could and set up a search and volunteer team. And not forgetting, I don't speak Chinese. I don't know anyone in China, and it's a city of 3 million people. So it was really a needle in the haystack job when I got there.
Okay, yeah, so this is just so amazing to me because, yeah, so you get back to this town, this city of 3 million people. You don't speak any Chinese. You don't really know anybody there. The people that had your dog was some type of, like, animal care agency that had the dog, and the dog ran off. And your goal is to find Gobi, this dog. So that in itself seems almost impossible. When you got there, you must have thought, this is never going, I'm never going to find this dog.
Yeah, flying into Urumqi and coming over the city, and it's a very densely populated city, but in the background, you've got mountains as far as the eye can see. And I thought, if Gobi's gone anywhere near those mountains, we'll never see her again, because you've got villages that have no communication or connections with the real world. So It was pretty daunting as I flew in and I got picked up, and the language became an issue straight away, and speaking there just to try and get to the hotel and also just to get out and to start speaking with some of the people that had begun to come together to look for her. It really became an issue for me to understand as to how we were going to go about doing it. And thankfully, I took on social media and had some translators working with me, and we just really targeted all of the media that we could in China, and it became not only the city of Urumqi, but the whole of China. It really felt like the whole billion people looking for this little dog.
That was Dion Leonard from episode 16, and Dion's written a book called Finding Gobi that's going to be made into a motion picture also. Speaking of people who've done extraordinary things, Joel Satore is a photographer with National Geographic. He was on episode 19 of Travel with Hawkeye this year, and he has created something called the Photo Ark, which documents all the species which are now extinct on our planet. And I think there's over 13,000 of them. And I had to start the interview with Joel and say, is there a profound sadness to this project?
Well, no, it's pretty common if we're looking just at the species for which there's really no hope of recovery. The show has a couple of animals in it that will probably go extinct. But it also looks a lot at the work that people are doing around the world to save species that got close but are rebounding.
All right.
So there's a lot of hope there, and there's a lot of inspiration. And we just use the tough ones, the ones that could go extinct. We use those as inspirational tools too, because we want to teach the world that this is life and death, and that as these other animals go away, so could we.
All right, so let's just give a broad overview on what this project is. We kind of touched on it a little, but it's about extinct creatures. But what you're doing and how grand this project actually is.
Right. Well, the Photo Ark is a 25-year effort on my part to document every captive animal around the world, every animal in human care, at aquariums, zoos, wildlife, rehabbers, private breeders, you name it. And the goal really is to get the public to care about the extinction crisis while there's still time to save everything. We photograph rare and common animals today, and we just want people to fall in love with these animals and learn they exist. We want to give them a reference point in a way and allow them to see that there's so much more to the world's animals than just gorillas and polar bears. There's all sorts of amazing things out there that need our attention.
All right, so this is a book, first of all, and now it's a PBS special. Is that correct?
Right. We've been working on this 11 years now, so the PBS show, the book, there's an outdoor exhibition traveling the nation's zoos, lots of things going on, but we figure it'll take, we've been at it 11 years, we have 6,500 portraits, studio portraits, of different animals, to date, and we figure we'll need another 15 years and we'll get all 13,000 species in human care around the world.
Wow, this has really become your life's work.
It has, yeah. We use studio portraits as a way of getting the reader engaged with the animal by looking them in the eye. And they're on black and white backgrounds to eliminate all distractions and also to give every animal an equal voice. In these portraits, there's no size comparison. So an elephant is every bit as big as an elephant is no more important than a mouse. And a tiger beetle counts as much as a tiger because everything's the same size.
It truly is an extraordinary project. You can hear our entire interview with Joel Satori on episode 19 of Travel with Hawkeye's podcast. And also, to kind of close out this year, this is one of our most popular interviews, and I really enjoyed meeting Jack Arnett, the master distiller at Jack Daniel's. And he was in town to talk about the new Tennessee Whiskey Trail, which the state of Tennessee has developed to visit all these different distilleries, not just the Jack Daniel's one. And I had to ask, what exactly is Tennessee Whiskey? Is it just simply whiskey that was made in Tennessee?
It takes more than that. Uh-huh. You know, I think a lot of people think that if you make a whiskey in Kentucky, that it's automatically a bourbon.
Uh-huh. But that's my next question.
Yeah, but it's not. You know, you can make bourbon in any U.S. Uh-huh. state. It is a product of America. Uh-huh. Distinctly, it has to be 51% corn. It doesn't necessarily have to come from Kentucky. Uh-huh. But if you put the words Kentucky bourbon then on your label, then it has to come from Kentucky.
Okay.
But, you know, whiskey's it's a global term. It can be made on any country on the planet. Mm-hmm. It just means that you take grain, you ferment it, you distill it, and then you mature it in a barrel. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the basic process statement that ties together Tennessee whiskey with bourbon, mm-hmm. with Canadian whiskeys, with Scotch whiskeys. That's kind of what we all do. We mm-hmm. ferment grain, we distill it, and we put it in barrels to mature it. But if you call yourself bourbon, you have to first be a product of America. You have to be 51% corn on your grain bill. You have to distill below 160 proof, mm-hmm. Where globally whiskeys begin around 189. And the lower you distill, the more character you have. So this was intentional on America's part that they wanted bourbon whiskeys, American whiskeys, to have a little bit more character.
Mm-hmm. When you say who is they?
The people who were writing the federal codes that define all the different types of spirits.
So this actual federal codes.
There are federal codes.
Federal trade codes?
Yes, the Code of Federal Regulations has a whole section dedicated just to our industry.
Okay.
And it defines what gin is, what vodka is, what Class II whiskeys are, what bourbons
Washington
are.
And Jefferson in on this? I mean, how far back does it go?
I'm not sure it goes all the way
but
back
it's more
that
of a
far.
But through the Federal Trade Commission.
Yeah, a lot of this stuff was written after Prohibition when they were allowing people to distill again. They created process statements and definition that define certain products and how they had to be made.
Okay.
But the biggest difference in bourbon whiskey and all the other whiskeys of the world is that you can't reuse barrels and call yourself bourbon. You have to be in a new charred oak barrel.
Oh.
You're prohibited from using colorings or flavoring, so they have to be all natural as
uh-huh.
well.
Uh-huh.
You have restrictions on your entry proof into the barrel and also your bottle proof. If you're in the barrel less than 4 years, you have to use age statement. So it drives a lot of honesty and transparency.
Uh-huh.
I think it for bourbon whiskeys and American whiskeys, and I'll often tell people I think there's great bourbons and maybe some not so great bourbons, but at least they're all natural and they're all honest in how they're being produced. Now Tennessee, was basically beginning to distill around the same time as Kentucky. Kentucky was largely becoming famous for bourbon. They were right in the heart of corn country and everything.
Yeah.
So there was a regional variant, I call it, of bourbon that came out of the area where we are. We're in Moore County, but originally the distillery was in Lincoln County when there were fewer counties in the state. So this thing called the Lincoln County process started to develop, and it was where people were taking whiskey from their stills and they were slowly dripping it through hard sugar maple charcoal.
Okay.
And what they were finding is that, the spirit, when it comes off the stills, can... being high in corn would tell you that it's going to be sweet because that's the nature of corn.
Yeah.
But corn has a tendency to cover its own sweetness up with a lot of bitter elements.
Uh-huh.
That's what the barrel's designed to address, is to soften the bitter edge using the barrel as a way of doing that. But what people like Jack Daniel and Charles Nelson and George Dickel from the Cascade Hollow Distillery, what they were learning is that hard sugar maple charcoal was even more effective and efficient at doing it. You need to spend days to mellow it. But it gives you a head start, kind of getting into the barrel.
Okay.
So if you take a bourbon and you put it through charcoal mellowing before you put it in a barrel, then you become a Tennessee whiskey.
I see. And there's an extra step.
There's no exceptions. There's just one additional step.
Uh-huh.
But it's that step that kind of defines Tennessee whiskey as being something different than bourbon.
You can hear our entire interview with Jack Arnett on episode 15 of Travel with Hawkeye. It has truly been an extraordinary
year. And I want to thank all our guests and all of you for making us part of our podcast experience. We're very excited about what we have to offer in 2018. I'm Mark Hawkeye Lewis. The world is out there. Your adventure awaits. You've been listening to the Travel with Hawkeye podcast.